Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsans will have the opportunity next Wednesday to hear one of the top spoken word poets come to town. Canadian Shane Koizan has used his own personal narrative to weave engaging, humorous, and haunting stories that explore issues of social justice, mental health, and love. He's most famous for his anti-bullying poem, To This Day, which has over 20 million views on YouTube and has spawned the anti-bullying group To This Day Project. Koizan was born in Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories to a French mother and a father of First Nations heritage. He grew up with his grandparents in British Columbia. He's the author of a number of collections of poetry and an autobiographical novel in verse, Stick Boy, which was later adapted into an opera by Vancouver Opera. Koizan performed his poem We Are More at the opening ceremonies of the 2010 Vancouver Koizan performed his poem, We Are More, at the opening ceremonies of the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. Here he is in action from one of his most recent pieces, Halos in the Trash.
A father once told me, there's nothing so cruel as a magic trick. And I thought he was joking, poking fun at my honest belief that there is something beautiful about the confusion that an illusion leaves in its wake. But he said, take for instance my little girl, who practiced magic for 8 years, conjuring smiles out of misery. She spent 8 years rehearsing how to vanish, until one day she did. Take, for instance, the mother whose kid was a wizard at transmuting despair into joy, the 6-year-old boy who had a respiratory illness so would produce laughter out of thin air. Or how about all the children everywhere who stare at birthday candles, then close their eyes and wish for hope? I can't imagine, or maybe I just don't want to. But I've met parents who can turn love into glue. They are the parents of dying children, and through tears they whisper, you do what you have to keep yourself together. And I understand. You tether yourself to uncertainty, but learn to broaden your scope. You force yourself to cope with even the idea of loss. For some, it's an early birthday party, just in case. For others, it's a chase, trying to track down even the tiniest moments, hoping to build memories upon the foundations of their every effort, bleeding into each new endeavor. No grand illusions of a happily ever after, just something simple like Christmas dinner in July.
That's my guest today, spoken word poet Shane Koizan, from his most recent piece, Halos in the Trash. He'll be appearing Wednesday evening, October 9th, at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus in an event sponsored by Tulsa's spoken word poetry group, OK So Tulsa. Information on the event is at eventbrite.com. Shane Koizan, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You've been quoted as saying that your grandmother once gave you an important piece of advice. It says, anytime you feel like you have no one to talk to this here notebook. That might have been some small solace at the time, but how important did that advice turn out to be?
It shaped my whole life. It became my career. You know, it's like I grew up friendless, and so not having anyone to talk to, and growing up, you know, feeling that isolation, living in an isolated place like Yellowknife, you know, there were days you walked around, it just felt like you weren't ever seen by anyone. And so, you know, my grandmother was very proactive and be like, if you feel like you have no one, you talk to this, you know, this will always listen to you. It certainly felt like, I mean, oh, this isn't a friend, like this isn't the same thing, you know, but in the long run, in the bigger scheme of things, it turned out to be everything. It turned out to be exactly what I needed. Because it gave me the keys to understanding myself as well. Because I could then go back and sort of chart my growth through whatever I was going through.
Do you still have those journals today?
Not all of them. I have some of them. But they're a treasure trove. You know, you go back and you look at how much you've progressed and evolved from, you know, the kid who, you know, was in school having a very dark time and writing, you know, just silly things in a notebook to all of a sudden, you know, like, I mean, here are some really deep thoughts about what I was going through. And I was like, that was amazing to see. And it became something that, you know, really helped me see where and chart. Like, I mean, it was like that line on the wall where you mark your kid's growth every year, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, the more I looked at it, the more I saw, it's like, here's how much I improved with this. here's how much better I've gotten. My vocabulary's increased, all these things. So it was very valuable for me.
When you go back and look at them today, what insights did they give you into your growing up? And because you mine so much of your personal life in your work.
You know, when she first gave me back some of my notebooks, because I just kind of left them around, but she kept them, my grandmother. And when she gave them back to me, it's like, at first I really didn't want to go through any of them because I thought, oh my God, it was just, I had such a dark time in school. It was so bullying. My mental health was not doing so great. But going back and reading through that time in my life, I could see there was still a kid there with a sense of humor, albeit a dark sense of humor, given what I was going through, but there was still some kind of light shining through. And it really gave me sort of this idea that it's like, if you're in a dark place, you have to make your own light.
Can you tell us how you got started doing spoken word poetry? Was that something you went to naturally, or how did you come to it?
No, I was in university, and I was a poli-sci student, ended up taking one of the creative writing courses, and one of the assignments was we had to organize and host our own open mic, you know, poetry night or whatever. And it just kind of snowballed from there. I felt immediate connections with people. It was the first time I'd ever shared poetry with anyone or any of my work out loud. But it was amazing to get that sort of instant response from people who were, you know, clearly had gone through some of the same things that I'd gone through. And not having experienced that in school, like university was a much different creature than, you know, just high school. So it just opened up my life in a way. And then from there, I ended up moved to Vancouver and got involved with slam poetry and the Vancouver poetry slam scene. And then things really started to, you know, evolve and pick up. And, you know, it was an interesting path.
That reaction to hearing your words spoken that first time, what was that experience like?
I really didn't think there was going to be any kind of reaction because I'd been to sort of poetry readings before and stuff like that. And it's all very polite and it's all very, you know, clap hands and stuff like that. But it was just way more raucous. And I would say a line and all of a sudden you'd hear somebody in the audience go, you know, it's like I just said them something delicious or something that nurtured their soul. So that felt really nice. And it felt really, you know, it gave me confidence that my own thoughts and feelings matter. Because if you grow up going to school and, you know, constantly being told nothing you say or think has value or meaning, if you hear that often enough, part of you starts to believe it. And so this kind of reversed that a little bit and opened up that door for me.
Now, of course, your work is intensely personal. You have this way of bringing listeners into the story and then all of a sudden flipping it. But, of course, one of the things you've been very honest about and probably your most powerful piece is on bullying. Of course, the first, as far as I know, the first time you wrote about bullying was your novel in verse, Stick Boy. Was that the first time you wrote about the bullying you experienced growing up?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's kind of a memoir of, like, living on both ends of that spectrum. Because as much as I was bullied really badly in school, there was a shift too where, you know, something in me just broke and I couldn't do it anymore. And so it became a bully, became that thing that I feared. So I've lived on both sides of this thing. Mm-hmm. And that's really what that book is about. And I just needed to address it.
Well, to this day, which is easily available online, is one of the most powerful anti-bullying pieces I've ever heard. And I love the idea, to this day. It's about that idea that to this day, every verbal assault, physical or emotional, just sort of is grafted into the bullied's life.
It's scar tissue, you know? It becomes something that you take with you through your entire life. As much as, you know, like, I mean, if you ever get a compliment, it's like, sure, that feels good. But those aren't the things that necessarily, the positive things don't necessarily stay with us. It's the negative things that we carry with us. Those are the things that become our luggage that we have to bring through the concourse of life, trying to get to some flight that we can get out of here, you know, or leave it all behind. But you don't. You take it with you everywhere.
Was there any trepidation about talking about this part of your life when you first
put it?
Yeah, I would think.
Absolutely. You're talking about a time where it's like the rise of, you know, internet trolls and stuff like that. Of course there was, you know, they came out of the woodwork for that kind of thing, you know, and it's the kind of thing where it's like, ah, you need to toughen up, or, you know, it's like, oh, go kill yourself then, or things like that. And it's like,
wow.
You know, all I'm saying is that we need to evolve past it. We don't need bullying anymore. What purpose does it serve? And so, to then, like, I mean, you put out a piece that's meant to be a salve for some people, and there are other people who all they can do is attack it and attack you. And so, of course, difficult. And I fully am aware that I grew up in a different time. I grew up in a time where when I was bullied in school, it stopped at 3 o'clock when I could go home. You know, nowadays kids live in a world where the internet is a window into your whole life, and people climb through it all the time to poke at you and prod at you and tell you things about yourself. So it's a much different world we're living in right now. The positive that I see in it is that, you know, when I was going to school, there were no posters, there were no support groups, there wasn't any of that. Now we have that. Now we have movements that talk about it. Now we have, you know, it's out there in the open. Why are we doing this?
You know, I never really thought about the idea that as an artist that uses the internet and uses digital media a lot in your work as a way of promoting your work, of sharing your work, that this is like an open window to just getting the worst of the internet coming back to you because your work is so personal.
Yeah. It, you know, and that's always going to be the whenever you share anything that's personal, you're opening a vein. Being vulnerable is perhaps a stronger armor than, you know, putting up the walls. The hard part about it is there's always somebody carrying a hammer that's, you know, willing to, you know, come up and smash you a little bit.
My guest today is Shane Coisan, a spoken word poet, writer, and performer. He'll be appearing at the Lorton Performance Center on Wednesday, October 9th, in an event sponsored by OK So Tulsa. He's an amazing writer and spoken word poet. Some important pieces like To This Day and many other pieces that he's written over the years. And tell us a little bit about the performance you're going to be doing, because so much of the work I've heard is, I'm going to just say, it's very earnest. It's about life changes. It's about personal experiences, deep personal experiences. I assume in a live performance, there's going to be a mix of a lot of, you know, some funny things as well as these sort of moving personal stories.
I mean, humor is how I survived. You know, humor is how I got through the darkest parts of it. So I think when people come to the show, they're always kind of surprised at how funny it is. My goal, my aim, is to take people through the range of their emotions, because we live in a time now where we're being told to shut off that part of ourselves. We're not allowed to be emotional anymore. If you're emotional at work, they want you to go home. You know, our empathy is being sort of destroyed in this way, where it's like, it used to be, it's like, if there was a story about some awful thing, it stayed with us forever. Now we scroll past tragedy on our Twitter feed like it's nothing. It's just crazy. So I really try to give people a space to feel their feelings again and reconnect with that part of themselves and remember that we're emotional creatures. And because it's important to remember you have those feelings and be aware that other people have those feelings as well. That's where we get that disconnect.
That disconnect can be so apparent. I love your piece, Places. I know that was a commission piece, I believe, but what I love about it is it begins as a self-involved piece for the listener, because it starts with,
right,
of all the places we have in our lives and the places we have to be, it's all about me, the school,
yeah,
the jobs, the grind of life, how I can knock the wind out of our sails. And then just when we're totally into our own situation, and as we're hearing you speak and sort of relating to our own lives, then you flip it. And all of a sudden it becomes, well, what if you don't have a place? It's one of the most powerful homeless pieces I've ever heard. Can you maybe talk about how you constructed that?
It was just one of those, like, I mean, I was homeless for a while living in Vancouver, so I know what it's like. I know what it's like to not be seen. And for a lot of the people who are homeless, and one of the things, there's a whole new class of people now. too, the working homeless. So that's where we are in society, that there are people who have jobs but are now homeless as well. They live in their cars but go to work. And, you know, they're doing everything they can to make it, but they can't make it. And to me, tragedy is a switch. It can get flipped on you at any time, at any moment, and you don't know how your life is going to change. It's chaotic. I think I say in the piece there are holes in the safety net in the shape of people, and it's absolutely true. We've let people fall through these cracks in society, and it's so hard because you walk past them every day, and we're numb to it. We're completely, doesn't matter to us. We try to look away. We try not to pay attention to them. And it's like, what would it be like to go walk through the rest of your life like you were invisible, to not be seen, to not be acknowledged every day?
One of the things I love about the imagery you use, it's so much of the vernacular in Halos in the Trash. You're talking about a parent that's lost a child, and you use such phrases as they canceled their subscription to faith after having lost everything. Grief comes in installments like paying rent, that every payment must be sent to a landlord they'll never meet. That is such strong imagery. And I love, where did that imagery come from? Is it come from your slam experience where you have to make this immediate connection?
It just comes from my own experiences with dealing with grief. I've had loss in my life, so I understand what it does to people. And it's losing a child is perhaps, I can't imagine a greater loss. I can't imagine anything that would hurt more than that. Not that I have children of my own. I know people who have lost children, and I've seen what it's done to them. Happy couples who couldn't go on because it just destroyed some part of them. You know, it's a heavy thing to see and acknowledge.
Can you talk a little bit about your process? How you create a piece? Is it something that gets worked out over the course of days, weeks, or even months, or in spoken performance and then worked on again?
Yeah, the editing process is where, all the real heavy lifting comes in. But I tend to write a piece backwards. I start with the end and work back toward the beginning because I want to drive everything to that one point. But so the first draft will come very easily. The first draft is always you're just creating the skeleton, right? And then it's like a reverse Frankenstein. The skeleton goes down first, and then there's the organs and the musculature, the tissue, the connective tissues, and then, finally the skin.
And that last point, is that the starting point for inspiration, like Halos in the Trash? You wanted to write about the tragedy of a family losing a child. Where does the starting point for saying, this is something I want to write about, this is something I want to share with people?
It's one of those things where it's like inspiration hits you in funny ways and it comes at you from all different directions. And it was just one of those moments. I don't want to talk about the exact moment because it's a very personal story and I don't want to get into it right now. But I think one of the things that people forget about inspiration is that it's not a self-generating thing. It doesn't come from inside of us. Inspiration is an outside source. It's an outside force. It comes at you from what you experience and what happens in your life. And inspiration isn't always a light thing. Sometimes something moves you in a way that, is deeply affecting, and that's inspiration too. But it's heavy lifting. It's all emotional excavation.
And so much of it seems so personal to you. I think is it difficult doing that night after night, sort of putting your own self out there so much to the public? Now you have people who are very much familiar with your work, they're there to get that. It's like you're feeding them in a way. But I still think that has to have some sort of emotional toll, telling these stories night after night.
Yeah.
And I assume you craft them as you're telling them every night after night, too.
Yeah. I don't know really how to explain. There's a lot of weight that comes with it. Because when I'm done a show, I always say after a show, I'll meet anybody who wants to meet me. I stick around to sign books and stuff like that. I'll stay for, as long as I can because I feel responsible for taking people to spaces that you know, may be traumatic for them, you know. And I take that responsibility very seriously, because the other side of it is, like, as much as I'm writing pieces that are helping people get through school and get through mental health and depression and things like that, there are the letters you get that they're from kids that are out on their particular ledges, and you do what you can to reach back. You give them the numbers because that's all you have, but then all you get back is silence. So you just wonder, am I touching a void here? What is going on? And so that becomes a weight of not knowing. It's like, is this person okay?
No, I
there's a lot to carry around.
I know you took like a year off. Now, some of that was some issues. I know you lost a very close family member, but I would think, was that a good time off for you, spending about a year off from doing this? I just think it you're almost like a counselor in a way.
Yeah, but that's the time I needed to work on myself. Like, I mean, I know when I get into a depression, I know how deep it goes, and I know, like, I mean, how debilitating it is. And, you know, there was a lot of days just not, you don't want to get up, you don't even want to shower, you don't want to do anything. That's what depression is. It's an anchor that, you know, like, I mean, it keeps you down. And so it takes time to shift that off of yourself and to find, you know, your feet again and start moving forward. It's like, you know, when everything was going great, it felt like a juggernaut. It felt totally unstoppable until the moment you're stopped. And then when you're stopped, you realize, wow, it takes me a lot to get moving again. You know, so it's like, when I'm moving, I'm good. But if I'm stopped, it takes everything to just put one foot forward again.
Well, I know you have a new collection coming out, and it's called The Inconvenient Skin. What is this new piece about? Because I understand it's a single poem.
Yeah, Inconvenient Skin is one long piece. It's about the 150, well, it's about residential schools in Canada. My dad was a residential school survivor. And I grew up, you know, with, you know, camouflage of being able to fly under the radar and be accepted as someone white. My dad did not have that experience. He had a very rough go of things, and Canada has a long history that it, you know, has had difficulty looking at itself in the mirror over. And I wanted to address that, because it's as much as I've struggled with my identity based on what happened, because, you know, even my grandmother, you know, I was raised by my grandparents, my grandmother cautioned me really strongly. It's like, you don't tell anyone, because, and she did it out of fear and love, because if they find out, they're going to come and they're going to take you away. So you grow up with that. You grow up fearing something inside your own blood. So, you know, and so it became this, you know, sort of strangulation of the soul, you know, like to not be able to sort of own your identity. And Canada needs to own this part of its identity. So, you know, the U.S. has its own history with this as well.
Yes, of course it does. So let me be clear. Your grandmother was telling you to deny your First Nations heritage because she was afraid the government would take you away?
My dad was part of the scoop. He was part of the RCMP. Like, I mean, in the 60s, they came and they took a bunch of people away. And my grandmother worked in a receiving home, which was a home for abused children. And she saw firsthand, you know, this sort of shock and anguish that goes along with these kinds of, you know, these kinds of experiences, the trauma that comes out of these things. And she was doing what she could do to protect me. And so she wasn't like, you know, like, it's hard to talk about, obviously. But yeah, I think she did what she felt she needed to do in order to protect me.
You said that your father went to a residential school. Would this be like what in the United States would have been Indian boarding schools, or was this a different sort of school that you're talking about?
I don't know what it is in the U.S., but uh-huh. Yeah, residential schools were in the 60s. It was called the 60s Scoop, where children, there's a fantastic piece of art, which is the cover of the book by Kent Monkman. It's called Scream, and it depicts RCMP and priests taking indigenous children away from their homes, separating them from their families, much like what we see going down at the southern border, and taking those children away from their parents and putting them in schools, taking them away from their families, and the trauma that was born out of that. And, like, I mean, the survival stories they're horrifying, you know?
Yeah.
Everything from sexual abuse to physical abuse, mental abuse, all of that. And it's an entire culture that's grown up with this stigma around it of hatred. And I just wanted to write about it.
The name of that new collection is called Inconvenient Skin. And this comes from a publisher, but for the most part, you self-publish most of your material. How did that come about?
I started off with a publisher and was just, you know, I guess I got disillusioned by the process of it, because here I was doing all the footwork, doing the tours, taking the books everywhere, and at the end of it, not really making anything, like not being able to sustain myself with it. And so while all that was going on, I just kind of, like, you know, sat back and took notes on, like, how does this industry work, and, you know, started to figure things out for myself, and then just really invested in myself to get started. And that's made a world of difference. It's made a lot of difference in my life.
When you think of a poet in our country, for the most part, you know, the traditional poet has a day gig. It sounds like you don't have a day gig. You work as a spoken word poet first and last.
Right. It's difficult. Like, I mean, you go to school and you tell people you want to be in the art, teachers, counselors, or whatever. There's a lot of people that, you know, they want to talk you out of it. And I get why that is. I understand that, you know, if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a fireman or a policeman or whatever, there's a clear path to becoming those things. If you go to this school, you take these classes, you're that. If you want to be an artist of any kind, you have to make your own path. There's nothing, you know, they can tell you, oh, go to this art school, but really it's like, if you're going to be an artist, you have to be self-motivating. You're your own boss. It's a risk every time. It's like walking off a plank. It's being an artist. I don't want to say, like, oh, you know, go pursue, like, I want people to go for their dreams. Yes, true. But it's like, the reality of it is quite frightening as well, because there's no unemployment insurance for this. There's no pension plan for what I do. I'm going to have to do it for the rest of my life. I'm okay with that because I love it. But, you know, it is scary sometimes wondering, like, oh God, where's the next gig going to come from? You know, as much as I said, you got to make your own light. You got to make your own steam too.
Well, we look forward to you making some of your own steam. When you come to Tulsa, we're looking forward to the appearance on October 9th. Shane, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and what an inspiration your work is. It's really moving and so personal, and you share it night after night. We'll look forward to hearing you share it here in Tulsa.
I can't wait. I'm so looking forward to it.
Canadian spoken word poet, writer, and performer Shane Khoizan speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be appearing at the Lorton Performance Center Wednesday, October 9th, in an event sponsored by OK So Tulsa. For more information on the event, visit eventbrite.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.